Well, we're going to cover a big subject tonight, the Federal Reserve. And interestingly enough, for many years, the analysts on Wall Street denied that they were Fed watchers. Because they, oh, no, we don't do that because we do our own analysis and we draw up our independent things on stocks and so forth. But the fact is they just watched the Fed and they knew when the Fed was going to raise or lower the interest rate. And it was very easy for them. And at the same time, they officially denied that this is the way they operated. So actually, the Federal Reserve made it a lot easier for Wall Street stockbrokers and speculators because the whole Federal Reserve system was set up originally to help speculation. That's all it was for. It was for people who wanted to speculate and make big money fast. Otherwise, they wouldn't even bother to put it through. Because what we had before the Federal Reserve System was we had a national system of what is called one-name paper. I lent you $10, you gave me a note for $10, and you repaid me the $10. Well, the international banking community knew that there was billions of dollars to be made from negotiable instrument, trading in debt. So we went from one-name paper to two-name paper, three-name paper. In other words, you would owe a debt to somebody, and that guy would sell it to somebody else for a small profit. He would sell it to somebody else, and everybody made a little money on the way. So they completely transformed the credit structure, not only of the United States, but of the entire world. And this trading in paper was called acceptances. You accepted a debt from someone else. So they had an official banking name for it, acceptances. And the biggest acceptance dealers in the world were the Rothschilds and their agent, Paul Warburg, who had a company in New York called the International Acceptance Corporation. So Paul Warburg was the actual author of the Federal Reserve Act. And he was part of the crowd that went down to Jekyll Island on a secret meeting the week of Thanksgiving, 1910. Now, they had the panic of 1907, which caused a lot of banks to fail and a lot of widespread misery. And so, supposedly, an outcry arose from the American people for banking reform. Well, this cry didn't come from the American people. It came from the Wall Street bankers. They were the ones that wanted banking reform because they wanted it on their own terms. But what they were conditioning the American people to accept banking reform. And so they had President Theodore Roosevelt create the National Monetary Commission in 1908. And to the National Monetary Commission was going to bring banking reform to the American people. So so who did they get for the National Monetary Commission? They got some of the leading bankers, Paul Warburg and some of the other people from Wall Street. Because bankers always say, well, if you're not a banker, you couldn't possibly know anything about banking. Well, you know to pay the note every month at the bank, but that's all you know. So they got bankers to study banking reform. So these studies consisted of trips to Europe. And so the National Monetary Commission took a couple of jaunts to Europe, and they were wined and dined all over Europe and by the Rothschilds and other bankers. But they came back with absolutely no results. This had gone on for 2 years. And so they issued a report that we have met with some of the leading bankers of Europe and we have studied the problem and we're now going over our results. Well, there were no results. So then they secretly went down to Jekyll Island, the Millionaires Club, and when they got there, everything was conspiratorial. They sent all the servants on vacation, the family servants, who of course knew them all, and they brought in servants for the occasion from the mainland who didn't know any of these people. And they agreed that they would only address each other by the first name. And they later called themselves the First Name Club. So Paul Warburg was Paul, Henry Davison was Henry, and Senator Aldrich was Nelson. I'm quite sure Senator Aldrich, who was quite a pompous guy, didn't like being called by his first name, but that was part of the act that they were going through to put this over on the American people. So they actually sat down and drafted this bill in the dining room of this hotel. And about 5 years ago, I suggested to one of the people I wrote for, L.T. Patterson of Criminal Politics, that he have a meeting down there. I said, we'll call it a commemorative meeting, just to memorialize the fellow. Well, he agreed, and he got his people together, and we all went down to Jekyll Island for the anniversary celebration. And it worked out real well. Jekyll Island's a beautiful place. The hotel has been redone, and it's no longer the Millionaires Club, of course. It's a Radisson, actually, Radisson and Jekyll Island. So you've got a Radisson right across the street here. So they're a pretty good hotel chain. And they have preserved the dining room just as it was when they wrote the act there in 1910. And they have plaques on the wall. And they say that these selfless bankers met here and on their own time and devised banking reform for the American people. So that's the way they put it across. But now they had to get this through Congress. And, of course, there was tremendous anti-banker sentiment in Congress, mostly from the Midwest and the Western states, which were the more independent people and also smaller populations, because the Eastern Seaboard had always been controlled by the international bankers. And that's why they have what they call the Eastern Seaboard Republicans, and they have the Republicans from the rest of the country, and they are totally different people, because the Eastern Seaboard Republicans are the old bankers, very what they call liberal Republicans, the Nelson Rockefeller people. And then you have the real Republicans are in the Midwest and the West. And they're mostly Republicans out in this part because people are very self-reliant and very independent. So when they went before Congress, they knew they had to have a good act. So they devised a plan that they would offer two separate plans to Congress. The Republicans would offer the Aldrich plan, which was the plan that they had drafted down in Jekyll Island to set up a central bank, and the Democratic Party would offer a Democratic plan which they called the Federal Reserve plan, and they were actually the same plan. Some commentators pointed out they were exactly alike. But generally the people fell for it, and there was a lot of publicity about there were attacks against the evil Wall Street Aldrich plan, and that. But luckily, we were being offered an alternate plan, which would be a people's plan by the Democratic Party to be called the Federal Reserve. So, if you were a good Democrat, you supported the Federal Reserve plan. If you were a good Republican, you supported the Aldrich plan, and so. But they really needed Woodrow Wilson. They knew he would sign the act into law if he was elected president. So they wanted to elect him president in 1912 in order to put this deal over. And the problem was he was not charismatic, and he had been president of Princeton. He was a dry, pompous, academic person, absolutely no popular appeal whatsoever. But Rockefeller and the National City Bank decided to go with him anyway, so they chose him as their candidate. But President Taft, the incumbent president, was a Republican, very popular. He was a really overweight guy. He weighed 300 or 400 pounds. He had to have a special bathtub at the White House, which you could put an elephant in. But he was very popular because he was good-natured, and we had prosperity. And so it looked like Taft was going to be elected. So they always come up with some kind of conspiratorial operation. So they went to Theodore Roosevelt, who, of course, was very unhappy at not being in the White House. He had served his term, and that was over. So and there really wasn't anything for him to do. So they persuaded Roosevelt to split the Republican Party and run as an independent Bull Moose candidate, which he did. And so that elected Wilson by a large majority. And so now Wilson had a mandate from the people to sign the Federal Reserve Act. So now they started the debate in Congress. Well, Congressman Lindbergh, the father of the aviator from Minnesota, led the opposition. And Lindbergh was a very knowledgeable person. He was the lawyer for some of the bigger companies like Weyerhaeuser Lumber. He represented them. And in fact, he built a 30-room mansion up there at Little Falls on the lake, on the, I guess it was on the Mississippi River. And a year later, it burned down. So they built a smaller house there, and that house is there today, and that is the Lindbergh Museum. I was there 2 years ago, and it's a very interesting exhibit. It's not far from Minneapolis. So Lindbergh led the fight in Congress, and he had a lot of support against the banking bill, not the Federal Reserve plan as it was offered. So Paul Warburg himself and some of the other bankers, for the first time in their lives, had to come down from New York and actually lobby in the halls of Congress. So they made every promise in the world to get that act through. And here is Paul Warburg, whom no one had ever seen in Washington before, he'd like to say in the background. Here he is walking through the halls of Congress to get people to enact the Federal Reserve Act. And because Wilson was not popular, they took a Virginia congressman. Wilson also was born in Virginia, by the way. He's born in my hometown of Stanton, Virginia. And Carter Glass was from Lynchburg, and he was very popular. So it was Carter Glass who got the Federal Reserve Act through Congress. And, of course, he lived on that very well for the rest of his life. They made him senator. And so he became very old in office and in the 30s. And, in fact, he was reelected twice after he was totally senile. He couldn't even make a public appearance or cast a vote in Senate, but it was sort of like a referendum in Russia or Germany, see. In Virginia, everything was totally controlled, so they reelected him twice after he was no longer able to even speak. And so this was just one of the triumphs of democracy that we have. But that was his reward for having gotten the Federal Reserve Act through, that he was guaranteed a seat in the Senate for the rest of his life. And he was finally replaced. He died, so they had to replace. They replaced him by a congressman named Willis Robertson, who was part of the old Harry Byrd machine. And Harry Byrd himself was part of the establishment. And his closest friend was Admiral Louis Strauss, who was a partner of Kuhn Loeb Company, the Rothschild Banking House in New York, which Paul Warburg was a partner of. So here you had Harry Byrd lobbying for the Federal Reserve Act, and you had Willis Robertson, who's the father of the great evangelist Pat Robertson, whom I went to college with in at Washington Lee. And at that time he was a plump, lazy boy, whom you would never think of either going into religion or banking. And in fact, his grades were so low he could not get into the Washington Lee Law School, even though his father was senator, chairman of the banking committee in Washington, and he was an old Lexington family. But he finally wound up going to Yale and squeaking through Yale. I don't think he ever passed the bar exam. So then his wife said, well, let's do something for poor people. So they started a little church and started broadcasting. And then he came down to Virginia Beach, and a friend of mine named Reverend Stallings helped him get set up down there. And they later parted company. I know the man well. And but Pat was on his way. And with this impeccable Wall Street background, Pat was able to build up a broadcasting empire. When your father has been chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, it does open a few doors, you know. So he always had plenty of financial support for this television empire which he built up. If he hadn't had that family background, he would never gotten off the ground, because nobody would put a dime in this kind of thing unless they were had certain goals that they wanted to achieve. And of course they used Pat Robertson politically ever since. He ran for president, and he's done various things, and he's always there when they need him. That's the important thing. You can't always use these people every day. But to get back to the battle for the Federal Reserve Act in Congress in 1913, Lindbergh was having enormous effect and it didn't look like they would ever get it passed. But Warburg kept working. And so what they did, they went through Congress, and they made every congressman tremendous promises. And but they still did not have a majority. So they waited until the Christmas vacation. And so when Lindbergh and the other Midwestern and Western congressmen went away for Christmas, they'd be gone 3 or 4 weeks, because we didn't have jet planes at that time. So as soon as they left town, they brought the bill up before Congress, and the Congress, which barely had a quorum, hastily passed it on December the 23rd. Well, even the New York Times said, legislation of this importance has never been passed under such circumstances, because congressional courtesy dictated that you would not pass on major legislation while the other congressmen who opposed it were away. I mean, it was just common decency. And so the Federal Reserve Act was actually fraudulent when it was passed, because it would never have passed if the opponents had not left town. So it was legal, but it was immoral and indecent that they passed it the way they did. That was the only way they knew they could ever get it through Congress. And so they said, well, if that's what we have to do, we'll do it. And they did it. And so that is the real background of the Federal Reserve Act, which few people know that. I actually researched in the New York Times and got the actual quotations, and I have it in my book, the commentary, when it was finally passed. And so the world was waiting for the Federal Reserve Act for a very simple reason. Europe had not been able to have a war since 1885. They were all set for a war, but all of the European countries had been bankrupted by their central banks. A central bank always bankrupts a country because they spend all the money. And so they knew the only way they could finance a world war was from the wealth of the American people. But without a central bank, they couldn't do that. So as soon as they got the Federal Reserve Act enacted into law on December 23rd, 1913, a few weeks later, J.P. Morgan Company, which had been represented at the Jekyll Island meeting by his lieutenant, Henry P. Davison, Morgan himself did not want to appear personally at the Jekyll Island meeting, because it would compromise the whole situation if they knew J.P. Morgan was there. That meant it was a banker's bill, so he stayed away. And Henry Davison, who was not so well known, was his right-hand man. And he organized the American Red Cross also. And so Davison was Morgan's man at the Jekyll Island Conference. And so the Morgan Company has always played a large role in the Federal Reserve. In fact, Alan Greenspan, the present chairman, before he was appointed to the Federal Reserve Board, was a partner of J.P. Morgan Company, which probably qualified him for that job, you know, and or at least J.P. Morgan thought he did, so that's why he got the job. See, all these Federal Reserve Board people are chosen by the Wall Street bankers. Obviously, the president, who nominally rubber stamps these appointments, he didn't know any of these people. He doesn't know anything about banking. I don't know when we've had a president who was a banker, because bankers for a long time have been in poor repute among the American people, and with very good reason. So if you could imagine a banker running for president, he wouldn't get very far. So what they have to do is pick other people and then put up the money for them to be elected. So these bankers have always put their people on the Federal Reserve Board, and as I say, the first thing they did was lend Great Britain $400 million from J.P. Morgan. Well, that was to start the World War One. It was like a declaration of war, but no one knew it. They thought, well, it's just an ordinary loan. And so then J.P. Morgan actually kept the money and became the purchasing agent for Great Britain in the United States. So he spent all that money in this country buying munitions for England and shipping the munitions to England so they could start the war. So that's how it was done. And, of course, Germany, after the war, they wanted to try the Kaiser for planning to make war against its peaceful neighbors and so forth. Well, actually, the Kaiser didn't know any of this was going on, or that he was being set up and that Germany was going to be attacked. So anyway, that's the way it worked. They started World War One, And only because they had the Federal Reserve System. And once they got it started, they realized, well, the central bank is going to be great. And sure enough, they did the same thing in 39. They started Act Two of the World War One, which became World War Two. And, of course, both times we had a president who campaigned for office on the pledge he would keep us out of war. Wilson campaigned in 1916, and he boasted to the American people, I have kept you out of war, and so you should reelect me. And then, of course, as soon as he was reelected, he took us into the war. Well, Roosevelt campaigned, he said, American boys will never die in foreign fields. And he stumped the entire country, assuring everybody of this. And so then, after he was reelected, of course, they had decoded the Japanese radio, and they knew that the Japanese fleet was on its way to attack Pearl Harbor. So they made sure not to tell anybody, because the Japanese were sailing under strict orders. If they were detected en route, or if they had any reason to believe that the Americans were expecting them, they were to turn around and go home, which would have meant the U.S. would not have gotten into the war. So the night before Pearl Harbor, three people met at the White House. That was with Roosevelt. That was George C. Marshall, Chief of Staff, and Bernard Baruch, who was the banker who was the intimate of the president's. And they were sitting there absolutely terrified in fear that the Japanese would turn back and that 3,500 American boys would not be killed the next day. And so anyway, their night's vigil paid off, and the Japanese attacked, and we were in the war. So that's how it was all done. One of the greatest acts of treason against the American people, and the fact that all these American boys died in the ships, you know, and sank and were killed and bombed. They were bombed. And they had not an inkling that all this was happening, although it was in, they knew in Washington it was coming. So to cover up for themselves, the Roosevelt administration then indicted Admiral Kimmel and General Short, the two commanders of Pearl Harbor, on the grounds that they had been negligent, that that they had let the Japanese come in there and attack them. And of course, they had not a clue that any of this was happening, and that Washington knew all about it and refused to tell them. In fact, I think the the army in Washington did send by ordinary first class mail a note to the Pearl Harbor commanders that they might expect a Japanese invasion, and it arrived there a couple days after Pearl Harbor, of course. But that was the most urgent way that they had of notifying our troops in Pearl Harbor that the Japanese were going to attack. So it worked out just right, and we were in the war, and everything was underway. So this is how a central bank works. It's constantly active politically. It's constantly planning for war. And the reason they plan for war is, like Ezra Pound said many years ago, wars are created to make debt, because ordinary peacetime commerce can be profitable. Goods are traded and people are employed. But war gives you the big money. When you get into war, you have billions and billions. And, of course, during World War II, we had a very interesting system of production. It was called cost plus 10%. So the more money, if you were manufacturing munitions, boats or guns or whatever, for the government, the more money you spent, the more money you made. So naturally, you were very generous to your workers, and you paid them enormous amounts of money, because every time you gave them a raise, you made an extra 10% on the raise. So nobody balked at this, and this was what they called the miracle of production of World War II. And all it was, they had unlimited funds from the government, and of course they made their money, and they got very rich. So in 1943, we did have a couple of successes, and Ezra Pound broadcast from Radio Rome at that time, and he said, well, you've had a couple of successes now, and you're scared out of your pants that the war is going to end. which, of course, they didn't want it to end in 1943. And that's why they fought World War II, to prolong it as long as possible. They had the step-by-step approach in the Pacific. Instead of attacking Japan, they attacked each one of these little islands at tremendous cost. Well, it was stupid, but it kept the war going.
Oh, yeah.
See, if it attacked Japan, it could have been over in a couple of weeks. That wasn't what they wanted. And it was the same way in Europe. They landed in Sicily and fought their way all the way up Italy through the mountains and so forth, which kept things going an extra year. Because if they had attacked France or Germany by land at that time, the war had been over in 6 months. But as they didn't want it that way, and so they prolonged it to 1945. So real strategy in a war is not how to win it, but how to keep it going as long as possible. That is when you have a bank behind it, because the bank wants to drag it out and make it as costly as possible, not only in money, but also in human lives. I mean, they were gambling with American lives when they prolonged the war and fought through the islands in the Pacific, fought up Italy. There was never, militarily, there was never any explanation that you could offer to justify this kind of campaign. And I guess Hitler knew what was going on anyway, because he was financed by the Bank of England. In fact, they put out the myth that the evil Hitler was financed by German industrialists, but in fact Hitler was disliked by the German manufacturing class, and so he had to go to Governor Montague Norman, governor of the Bank of England, to get his money. And he was broke when he went into office in 1933. So we had to fly a couple of lawyers to Cologne to meet with him and to assure him that he would get the money to keep him going. So, you know, they have war crimes for people like that. They had war crimes trials for people who plotted war. Well, the two war criminals in this case were John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles of the firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, who were the lawyers for the international bankers. And the Dulles brothers went to Cologne and assured Hitler he would have money to keep the Nazi administration going. And he was actually financed, too, by the Schroeder Company of London. And one of the Schroeder directors, F.C. Tyrwhitt, was a director of the Bank of England. So he had the governor of the Bank of England and Tyrwhitt behind him. And with the money of the Bank of England behind him, Hitler was assured of having a Nazi regime and of starting World War II, which was the whole plan anyway. They didn't care what Hitler did as long as he got World War II going. And so that worked out, and that's how they had it. Without Hitler, there would never have been a Second World War, which means that the bankers would have lost many billions of dollars in profits. So he was a good investment for them. And so that's why they call him a monster today, because they don't want anybody to know about their association with him. Or, now they did try to indict Lieutenant General Schroeder, a German, who was head of the SS for war crimes after the end of World War II. So he was arrested very briefly and held in a camp and under British jurisdiction, and quietly dropped. He was never tried. And he was the man who made the whole Hitler-Nazi administration possible. So the war crimes trials, the Nuremberg trials, they were recently reshown again. And the only reason they ever held the Nuremberg trials was that they wanted to silence the German generals who had knowledge about all this duplicity and how the Bank of England had financed Hitler. Well, they wanted to permanently silence them, so they hung them. And their crime was not war crimes at all. It was the fact they knew too much. And they were silenced, and they managed to conceal the background of what was going on. So this is how central banks work. They use everybody, and when they're through with you, they get rid of you by whatever means. They hang you, or you just disappear. And so this is the Federal Reserve system that we think is a unique American institution. And the Federal Reserve Bank of New York alone, now there are 12 banks, of course, 12 Federal Reserve banks, but the bank in New York is called the Money Center Bank, and that is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York makes all the major decisions. Now, there was a piece in the paper yesterday about the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And, in fact, he's a minor figure. He has no authority whatsoever. All the power is in New York. But they try to promote the other 11 presidents of these other 11 banks just to make them feel important, I guess. But the Money Center Bank has always done everything. And it was the directors of this one bank in New York, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which financed communism, and they were active in helping the Nazis, and they were active in helping the fascists in Italy. So all of these great political movements of the 20th century came right out of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And that alone is a historical fact, which is very significant. But if you send your offspring to Yale or Princeton or Harvard, they will never hear one word about any of this. So I don't care how much money you spend, they're not going to get this information. It's all a matter of record, but the professors know that they have very cushy jobs. They pay their professors very well now, about $150,000 a year. They get long vacations. They get all sorts of special perks, trips to Europe for conferences and things like that. Their children all get scholarships at the best colleges. So they're well taken care of. So they don't rock the boat. And they know to a T what they need to tell their students and what to keep from them. And, of course, the main thing is they keep everything from them. They really don't know anything. And it's a very unfortunate situation, because when you see the price of college education in this country today, I think it's about $120,000 for a four-year stint, and to realize that those students are being denied practically all information about what's going on, it's really robbery of a very gross kind. But that's the way the system is operated. And the reason is that all of these so-called Ivy League schools, like you have the Harvard School of Business, the most prestigious business school in the United States. Well, J.P. Morgan had a partner in the First National Bank called George Baker. George Baker was president of the bank, and they worked together for many years. Of course, George Baker made hundreds of millions of dollars. So he gave $25 million to Harvard for the School of Business. And the name is right there today, George F. Baker School of Business, because he gave him all the money. Well, why did George F. Baker give $25 million to Harvard for the School of Business? Because he knew that the students there would never be told anything about what's going on. In other words, he made an investment. He made an investment in the future that the students would never find out what they had been doing. And that's true. The Harvard School of Business was set up to return short-term profits. And anybody who's gone through the Harvard School of Business and become head of a Fortune 500 corporation, which many of them do, has the worst possible training, because they're not taught long-term development strategy. They're taught short-term profits. Make it in 3 months. Make junk and sell it fast. Make some money. And that's the total philosophy of that school. Well, that came from George Baker. Because short-term profits, your banker wants you to make quick profits and pay off your loans to him. So he's not interested in a five-year or a 10-year development program where you make something really good and make it, you know, something that can be admired throughout the world. They want you to turn out cheap junk, sell it fast, make a quick profit, and pay the banknotes. So this is the philosophy of the all the schools of business, because they follow the example of Harvard School of Business, Wharton School of Finance. These are the models. So they all fall into line and teach their students the same thing, which has been very destructive, because American corporations have actually fallen behind in development over the last 25 years. Japan and Germany, of course, have pushed way ahead and have done much better because they do not have the short-term strategy. The only way you could make real profits and build your company is to have a long-term strategy of development, research, building up your market, satisfying your customers. But American corporations are run like McDonald's. They turn out hamburgers real fast, and they make money. But what's the future on that? I mean, the McDonald's hamburger 10 years from now will be just like it is now. Maybe they'll extract a little more of the flavor from it, but they've done that already, so I don't think that'll happen. So, when I was talking about people on Wall Street watching the Fed, they are operating from this same short-term results strategy. And so they really know just about what the Fed is going to do throughout an entire year. At the beginning of the year, they have an idea of what the interest rates are going to be or interest reductions for that entire year. But they pretend that it's a great mystery, there's tremendous secrecy. They still will not publish the minutes of the Federal Reserve meetings of the Federal Reserve Board. Now, the Federal Reserve controls the economy through two ways. One is the interest rate, which is the price of money. Well, they control the economy through the interest rate. If they raise the interest rate, less money is available for investment, so prices go will fall on Wall Street because the money to buy stocks is reduced. But the real operation is done through what is called the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee. Now, I've been writing about and studying the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee for over 50 years. Well, Time Magazine has, very highly paid journalists. So on March the 23rd of 2000, they did a feature story on the Open Market Committee. I printed pictures of the members, told how they operated and everything. They discovered this in the year 2000. Well, I discovered it in 1948. So that puts me a little ahead of them. And Time Magazine, of course, was founded by these same bankers in 1923. So from 1923 to the year 2000, they never knew that there was such a thing as the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee. Well, what is the importance of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee? Well, it determines the volume of money available for investment at any time. The Open Market Committee buys or sells government bonds on the open market. Now, when they want prosperity and they want the market to go up, they buy government bonds. And so that creates more money. And so there's more money available for investment. And the next day after they do this, the stock market will go up 100 points. So anybody who happens to know that that's going to happen, and there are people who know, is in a very good position. But the average American investor has no clue as to this great secrecy of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee. So they don't know it until it's printed in the paper that the Federal Reserve is buying bonds. Now, they do the opposite to depress the market. The Open Market Committee will sell the government bonds, and so that extinguishes the debt, and that reduces the amount of money in the system, and it's like turning off the spigots. No more water coming out. So then the stock market drops precipitously. Here again, it's quite advantageous to know the day before that this is going to happen. And, of course, the general public never knows. But there are people who do know. And when you have somebody like Greenspan, chairman of the board, from J.P. Morgan and Company, now, he doesn't call up J.P. Morgan and tell them they're going to do this. J.P. Morgan calls him up and tells him to do this. So it's not that he's given them any advance information. He's just doing what he's told to do. And this is the way it's been. As I say, the whole Federal Reserve System was set up for speculators, for these people to have advanced knowledge of monetary movements, how much the price of money, the interest rate, and the volume of money that's going to be available for investment. Either it's going to grow or it's going to be less, but they decide all that ahead of time, and so they make enormous fortunes. And so the other investors, they have to do what they call Fed watching. They have to watch and guess what the Federal Reserve is going to do. Because I say, now, people have sued to have the minutes of the Federal Reserve Board meetings made public. In fact, we had a chairman of the House Banking Committee a few years ago, Henry Gonzalez, from Texas, And Henry Gonzalez sued them several times to try to get these minutes and to avoid the secrecy, but he never got anywhere because you go into courts on a deal like that. And, of course, the judges are Federal Reserve judges. They may not be labeled that, but they always go with the Federal Reserve. And many people have asked me why I never sued the Federal Reserve during all these years, knowing what I know about them and having it all documented in this book. Well, to launch a suit like that, you do need quite a lot of money, $500,000 or $2 million. And, of course, the advantage the Federal Reserve Board has, a central bank, whatever money you can put into a lawsuit, they can print enough, 10 times that much money to fight you.
Now, down the base and print a little more.
That's right. So if I was able to print money, I would sue the Federal Reserve tomorrow. But unfortunately, my resources are very modest. And most people who are interested in this sort of thing, they're very modest. Because you do not get very wealthy people to get into this fight. Ross Perot would never put up any money for you to sue the Federal Reserve Board. Because they'd wipe him out tomorrow. And Ross Perot played the political game for years before he became a presidential campaign candidate. He was the largest single contributor to President Nixon. He gave him $300,000. He was the largest single contributor. And he didn't do that because he liked Nixon or anything else. He did that because he was maneuvering to get these enormous Social Security and other computer data contracts from the government. So he set up a company called Electronic Data Systems, EDS, which was programmed to handle these enormous paperwork things that were set up by these Social Security Administration, workman's compensation, all these things. And he had the only system which could handle it. But having the only system, it didn't mean anything. It didn't mean that much, because no matter what kind of government contract you get, you got to pay off to get it. I mean, nothing for nothing. That's the old motto of Washington. They claim that they used to have it on the wall in the House Office Building over one congressman's door, nothing for nothing. So I don't know if that's true. But anyway, even Ross Perot, who had the system to handle all this, and of course these were enormous contracts, he still had to pay his way in. So he donated $300,000 to Nixon, and he got the contracts. And of course he became a billionaire because these were very huge contracts. So Ross Perot then came out as a white knight on a charger. He was going after Congress, and he was going to bring a businessman's point of view to Washington. Well, he was a businessman. In fact, all of his business had been done with Washington.
Yes.
But the idea that he was going to change anything was ridiculous, because he was part of the system. And see, Bill Gates was the same way. Bill Gates became the wealthiest man in the world. And with his Microsoft Corporation, his computer operations. And but these people in Washington were getting very disgusted with Bill Gates. And he didn't know it, because he didn't know what was going on. He was spending $1.5 million a year in Washington. Here he was, biggest corporation in the country, richest man. He's spending $1.5 million. Well, my gosh, even a delicatessen would spend more than that. So they were getting very angry with him, and they realized they had to send him a message. So they had the Justice Department indict him for monopoly. And he finally got the message. He's now spending about $25 million in lobbying, $25 million a year lobbying in Washington. So now he's become a member of the team, and the Microsoft thing is not going anywhere, of course. This judge ruled against him, but that was only so you could appeal. Lawyers know that they always want you to lose the first go-round, because then you can appeal for years, and this brings a cash flow into the firm. And the firm, of course, is a law firm, and to have a firm, you have to have money coming in. So this thing will drag on, and they're not going to split Microsoft into two companies, because they haven't the faintest idea how to do it. But the threat is there. And I will say Gates has taken it all very well. He realizes he was set up, but it was his own fault. Well, I had thought for years why doesn't Bill Gates start spending a little money in Washington? Why doesn't he share the wealth like everybody else? But he had no idea that he's out there on the West Coast. He had no clue as to this is the way things are done. But under a totally corrupt Federal Reserve system, this is how politics work. Yeah, he got his education very quick. But so that is the way that the Federal Reserve system works. And it is total corruption from the very beginning. It began as a criminal conspiracy. People used to ask me, well, what is the Federal Reserve? It's federal, which means it's government, and it has reserves, and it's a system. Well, it's not federal, and it has no reserves. It doesn't need any reserves. When you can print all the money you want, why would you need any reserves? I mean, if you need $10 billion, you go down and print it. You don't have to have any. You don't go to the bank vault and drag out $10 billion. Just print some more. And it's not a system at all. It's a robbery system. I call it the federal robbery system rather than Federal Reserve, since there are no reserves, but there's certainly plenty of robbery. So every person in this country is being robbed by these people. And when they raise the interest rate, they're robbing you. When Greenspan started raising the interest rate, it means you got to cough up another $1,500 a month on your mortgage or lose your house and go live in a trailer. And you haven't got any raise. I mean, you're not making $1,500 a year more. But the interest rate pushes you into that position. You've got to come up with the money or lose your home. And this is what the Federal Reserve does to people. You got a note on your car, and suddenly the interest rate goes up on that. Or you borrow money for your business, and that goes up, and maybe your business is not making that much profit. You lose your business. So these are very serious and very cruel things, because when these bankers raise the interest rates, they don't worry about whether you can meet your bills or not. If you don't meet your bills, they'll foreclose on you, take your business, and you go to work for them at a much lower salary. And so that's how it's done. But it is a system of exploitation, of robbery, because when you take money from people and don't give them anything in return, that's robbery. Because under all normal commerce, if you buy something or spend money, you get a product in exchange. With the Federal Reserve, you get nothing except the debt. You get an increase in your debt, and that's it. You do not get any goods or any advantage of any kind. You've got the same house you were living in, but it's costing you an extra $1,500 a month. And that's about how much Greenspan has raised the average mortgage in the country. So if you can imagine, everybody in the United States is paying an extra $1,500 a month. And they've got to raise that money by whatever means they can. Sell assets, or sell the house and move to a smaller house, which many people have done.
I don't understand what you mean by that. When I know my mortgage is a fixed rate, anyone that I get are a fixed rate. So when you talk about raising interest rates, they can't raise my interest rate for my house. It's a fixed rate.
Well, fixed rate mortgages are not affected, but many of the mortgages are not fixed rate anymore. They put them on a sliding scale. So you must have one of the old, very desirable fixed rates.
I guess all of them I get a fixed rate. I've never been on a sliding scale.
Well, all of them were fixed rates for a long time. And then, you know, they were tipped off that they're going to start raising the interest rate, so they started moving them over into I don't know exactly how they set it up, but they make variable mortgage. They move to variables. So you've got the fixed rate. You're okay. They can't do anything to you.
The thing I want to do in the future is interest rates grow up, and it's going to cost me more just for the cost of business for the future borrowings I have.
Oh, definitely.
But for current things, it doesn't affect me at all.
So you're locked into the fixed rate. You're okay.
Anything I do is that way.
But if you go into another business or something, you're going to pay the higher rate.
Yeah, so. But also all the businesses now have to pay higher rates for their loans, which means they're going to have to raise prices.
Yeah, and the business loans are where they really make their money, because most businesses have to borrow money to start up or to expand and so forth. So the house mortgage is not the ideal example, because people in house mortgages are on a more fixed income, but businesses are totally at risk. They've got to raise the money or they won't have a business. So it's the businesses that really get hurt by this. But you don't hear the Republican Party complaining about the interest rates and so forth. Because the Republican Party, being liberal Republican, are for the bankers, and they go along with the Federal Reserve on everything. And it's amazing, too, what unanimous approval there is throughout the United States for the Federal Reserve system. You'll never hear a businessman or a politician criticizing the Federal Reserve. The only criticism for Greenspan's 6 interest rate increases since the first of the year came from the Wall Street Journal, which is sort of a voice of sanity.
Yes.
And they had a number of articles on their editorial page in which they criticized Greenspan's action. Well, you know, they absolutely laughed at his claims that we were under inflationary pressure. Well, there was no inflationary pressure at all. They published the actual figures, and there was no inflationary pressure. So then Greenspan, because of this attack on the Wall Street Journal, he kind of changed his tactics. He said, well, what he was attacking was the wealth factor. Well, that made it look like he was going after the rich. So everybody thinks that's okay. Go ahead and soak the rich. But it's not the rich that pay the bills. It's the middle income and poor people that pay the bills. The rich always get a special deal, you know, special discount, or they own the bank that owns the note, and they're paying themselves. But middle income and poor people don't have that advantage. So they are the ones who are the ultimate victims of all of these policies of the Federal Reserve Board, because wealthy people always benefit from these things. They have it set up so they benefit. That's why I said that the original Federal Reserve plan was conceived by very rich people who wanted to get even richer. There were no poor people at the Jekyll Island meeting. There were no middle-income people. These people were already very wealthy, and they had this personal view of themselves as pirates. They really felt like they were sailing the seas under the Jolly Roger. And in fact, if you look at the names of their yachts, they all had yachts. So George Baker's yacht was called the Viking. And J.P. Morgan's yacht was called the Corsair, which is Corsair is a raider. So they really believed in themselves as pirates. I mean, these were not people who were out to do good in the world or to help anybody. They were out to rob and pillage, because that's where the real money comes in. I mean, you can work all your life at a modest salary, or you can go out and rob people and make a lot of money very quickly. Well, these people deliberately chose the path of robbery, and it's the only path that they have. And they donate large sums to churches and universities of the stolen money, of course. But they've set that up so they get a big tax write-off. Usually it hardly costs them anything, because they learned long ago that when you're robbing people, it's better to promote an image that you do good, you know. So that's what they do. These are all great philanthropists, all these people.
Rockefeller, did he hand out the dimes?
Rockefeller handed out dimes, yeah.
To the kids, you know.
Oh, yes.
Great philanthropists.
Yes, he handed out dimes. No folding money, but just dimes.
Dimes.
In fact, he'd get the dimes by the roll, you know, and he would hand them out. But that was his great thing. Well, to give old John D. credit, his sons and grandchildren don't even give anybody dimes. They don't give him anything. You never heard of David or Nelson Rockefeller giving anybody a dime or giving them anything. So he was more generous than they were. But old John D. set up the Rockefeller Foundation, and he was so hated at that time. Now remember, this is the man who organized the Federal Reserve meeting, and his son married Nelson Aldrich's daughter. So Nelson Aldrich represented money and privilege in the U.S. of 1900. Republican majority leader, he owned banks in Rhode Island, he had stock in everything, and he lived in a huge mansion, and his daughter married John D. Rockefeller. So, in fact, that's how Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller was named after the man who chaired the Federal Reserve Board meeting. So that's how involved these people were in this whole thing. And John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s sons were named the Fortunate Five. You know, Nelson and David and Lawrence, they were the Fortune 5. They were the five wealthiest young men in the United States. Had the most desirable for marriages, of course. They were the best catch because they were all going to inherit the Rockefeller fortune. And the people who bought the original Federal Reserve stock in 1914 had a monopoly because they included in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 that the stock could never be bought or sold on any exchange. So if you wanted to buy stock in this magical money machine, which printed money, you couldn't do it because they had set it up that it would only be available to the people who bought it initially and who, of course, would hold on to it through their families. And so then Rockefeller set up the Rockefeller Foundation and put his Federal Reserve stock in that, so that it could never be touched anyway. So that's where it is today, and that is part of the capital of the Rockefeller Foundation. Well, Rockefeller was so hated that when he tried to charter his Rockefeller Foundation through Congress, he couldn't do it. So he finally chartered it through the legislature of New York, which he owned anyway, and it was never chartered as a national foundation because nobody in Washington dared, the Senate didn't dare vote for it. So he had it there for 2 years. He couldn't get it, so he went back to New York and chartered it. And the Rockefeller Foundation then financed the takeover of the medical profession through his Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research. And they have given us this big drug deal that we have today with all of the pills and all of the whole complicated medical insurance and medical practice of today. All came from John D. Rockefeller. Why? Was he really interested in people's health? No. He had the oil monopoly, and he was looking for other things, so he went into the medical profession, took that over. I went into the banking business and took that over from the Federal Reserve System. So this was a man who was growth-minded, as they say. He just kept growing and growing, dominating more and more. And as he went into each of these fields, he took them over totally. For instance, in the medical field, he set up a system where hospitals could only be accredited by the state legislature. And so then he controlled the legislature, so he now controlled all of the hospitals. So if you wanted to set up a hospital which, say, would offer free care to a certain number of indigent people or something like that, you couldn't get the legislature wouldn't approve it. You wouldn't be accredited. And without accreditation, it was against the law to operate. They'd come and close you down. Armed police would come and shut the place down and throw you out. So this is, they always fall upon force as a final factor, because only by force can they force people to do the things that to rob them the way they do. You got to have force. There's no way you could sit down and persuade the ordinary person to give you all of his money. You have to use a gun. So that's what all of these Federal Reserve influenced legislatures, revenue agencies, everything, the force is their only solution. And the IRS particularly has a habit of demanding initially at least five times what they know that you owe. If they think you owe $60,000, they'll send you a notice for $300,000. Well, the average person is totally devastated by a demand for $300,000. They don't have it. They don't owe it. They never owed it. So this conditions you to start negotiating and bring down the $300,000 to a more reasonable figure. So you wind up, you may owe them $60,000, but you wind up paying $120,000 because you got to pay more in order to get a settlement. So that's how they operate. They've been doing that for many years. Well, this is fraudulent. The IRS knows when they send out the claim that it's fraudulent, and you know it's fraudulent, but you can't go to court and prove that, because any court would say, well, the IRS agents worked this up from the information they had and from their statistics, and we can't challenge that. So some people have committed suicide because of these impositions. And as I tell you, the income tax was set up solely to cover up the fact that the Federal Reserve bankers had gotten a license from the government to print as much money as they wanted, and there's no restraints on it whatsoever. That's why they needed the income tax in the first place, was because they had to have some system of control, and that the income tax was that system. And they've been using it ever since, and it's invalid now, and it was invalid at that time. And as Bill Benson pointed out, to get the income tax amendment through the state legislatures, in every case, they use subterfuge, and in most cases, it was never even ratified in the first place, but they went ahead and listed it as being approved. And when he started doing his research, he was amazed at going to legislature after legislature and finding out it was totally fraudulent. It had never been ratified in the first place. So nobody actually owes any income tax at all, because the amendment was passed under fraudulent circumstances. And the man who approved it as Secretary of State was Philander Knox, who was the Wall Street lawyer for J.P. Morgan and the big the bankers who wanted the income tax. They knew they had to have the income tax, that they could not work the Federal Reserve system unless they had the income tax, because that was the only means of control that they had. And the income tax then became a weapon. They used force against people. They'd go in and seize your business, seize your home. I had a friend in Washington that owed tax, or they said he owed tax, and so he came home and went to bed at night, and during the night they came and took his car. He just had a little Volkswagen. They took his car, and to show you how blackmail and extortion is behind all of this, he went to the IRS and bought his own car back for a few cents on the dollar. And as long as the money changes hands, they're told to bring in money, and they bring in money. They're all on a quota system, and they have to bring in money or they never get promoted. So he bought his own car back for like something like $200, but now he had a car again. And that's the kind of this is a so-called government. This is not a government at all. Yes.
Are we allowed to ask questions during this discussion? Or?
Yes, I think we've reached the point now of the workshop where we're going to the question and answer. So you go ahead.
I have a question. I first understood that when they passed the Federal Reserve Act on Christmas Eve, that there were actually only four people in the room. Isn't that true? It wasn't a they called it a quorum, but it was really four people in the room.
Well, they said it was a quorum, but I wasn't there, and these people lie about everything. So I don't think there probably was a quorum. But I don't know how you'd ever prove that, you
well,
see.
He seems to know, too. I mean, we know that there were four people in the room, and we knew what sent.
Well, see, the New York Times didn't cover any of that. And, of course, my source was the New York Times. Uh-huh. But I don't doubt it that it was totally fraud. I don't see how they could ever have passed it when all these congressmen had left town. There's no way they could have had a quorum.
Well, they did the same thing with the Brady Bill.
Oh, the Brady Bill, yeah, exactly.
Exactly,
sure.
Exactly the same thing.
Yeah, whatever they want, they get.
Until everybody left to go on vacation, and that's when they did their thing in the 11th hour. Well, it was 11 o'clock at night.
11 o'clock at night, yeah, they do that. I used to live in Washington, and we would see the lights on in the Capitol building when they were doing one of these things. George Stimson, who founded National Press Club, he and I would have dinner together sometime and walk home at night. He lived at the George Washington Inn, which was just past the congressional offices, and we passed there one night. It was a summer night, and all the lights were blazing in all the in the Capitol, and they were debating the Marshall Bill, which was one of the great Rockefeller giveaways, because all the Marshall Plan, they couldn't call it the Rockefeller Plan, which is what it was, so they put George Marshall's name on it. It became known as the Marshall Plan, but it was actually the Rockefeller Plan to keep war production going. Because the Rockefeller plants, of course, the war was over, and they would have to close down. So they kept the plants in production, only now they called it aid. And so they kept sending stuff to Europe at American taxpayers' expense for Rockefeller's profit, and it was called aid. They gave them the stuff. Yes?
I would like to have, I understand up until World War II and everything that happened. I don't know if you have enough time to kind of give us an overview of what's happened since then.
Where is this all going?
Well, it's just going, it's business as usual. They're continuing the same old system. As long as they got the Federal Reserve Board in place, they can raise the interest rate, lower the interest rate, make the stock market tighten up, expand the stock market. They've got a very workable system. I don't see any changes in it unless they're forced to change. And the Congress is totally controlled. There's only one person in Congress today, Congressman Ron Paul, whom I know very well, who will criticize the Federal Reserve. He's a lone voice. Well, in Washington, when you're a lone voice, you're really alone. Everybody knows you're alone. They know that Ron Paul is standing there, that he has no supporters in either party, either house.
He's got guts.
Yeah, he's got guts, but he's willing to do that, well, because first he's a man of principle, and he has a very safe seat in Congress from Texas. And the voters in his district will continue to send him back to Washington, but he won't be able to accomplish anything. Now, there's always been one man, one congressman in Washington who would oppose the Federal Reserve. During the 1920s, it was a congressman from Pennsylvania who was a banker himself and was appalled, and his name was Congressman McFadden, and I mentioned him quite a bit in my book. And he died suddenly at a banquet one night, a political banquet, and everybody assumed that he was poisoned because he was a very dangerous opponent. And when Eugene Meyer was proposed for member of the Federal Reserve Board, that's the guy that bought the Washington Post, McFadden held hearings and showed that Eugene Meyer, who was a partner of Bernard Baruch, Baruch was appointed head of the War Industries Board during World War I by Wilson after a $50,000 contribution, and which was a lot of money at that time. And his partner, Eugene Meyer, they had the Alaska Juneau Gold Mining Company in Alaska, which is, I think, a typical fake mining operation. But his partner was appointed head of the War Finance Corporation. So you had Meyer and Baruch running Washington during World War I. And so Meyer apparently was a rather creative person. And as head of the War Finance Corporation, he printed Liberty Bonds, which they sold to finance the war. And it was your patriotic duty to buy Liberty Bonds. And Meyer was such a patriot that he thought as long as he was printing them, he would print them in duplicate, one for himself and one to sell to the people. So as head of the war finance, he printed all the Liberty Bonds in duplicate, and the others he sold on New York through his firms up there. No one knew that they were duplicates, of course, because who's going to check the numbers of Liberty Bonds? And so with that money, he bought a big chemical company after the war, and then he bought the Washington Post. So the Washington Post was printed with the money which Meyer stole as head of the War Finance Corporation. So Louis McFadden brought this out during the hearings. And then he complained that when Meyer's assistants were bringing in the books of the War Finance Corporation, this was 1931, and the war, of course, ended in 1918, that when they brought the books in, you could see that most of the pages had been altered. In other words, Meyer's accountants were sitting up all night changing the books before they brought it to McFadden. And of course, this is another criminal endeavor. But there again, McFadden was a lone wolf, and nothing was ever done about it. And Meyer was approved by the Senate as a member of the Federal Reserve Board. And that's all in my book, too. So then after McFadden died, another congressman came along from Texas, and he was from Texarkana. And now I have to look and remind myself his name. Wright Patman. And I used to go to Wright Patman's office, and he had my book right on his desk. And I quoted, I cited his letter in there from Wright Patman that he had always thought of very highly of my book. But even Wright Patman, as a personal friend, was afraid to have me testify at hearings on the Federal Reserve. I was never asked. Here I was, I'd written the book, I had done all the research. I was the authority on the Federal Reserve System. I was never once asked, even by Wright Patman, to testify about pending matters when they were investigating the Federal Reserve Board. Never.
When was this investigation?
Oh, they've had investigations of the Federal Reserve Board off and on ever since 1925. But they never amount to anything because, and the press never covers them. But I found all of these books of the congressional investigations in the Library of Congress, never been read or quoted by anybody.
So what's your next step? I mean, obviously they're incredibly greedy. You know, we hear about this talk about, you know, United Nations taxes, and I would think there would be all, you know, the Federal Reserve and the other central banks of Europe that are going to, you know, try to put this new scheme together. How do you see that playing out?
Well, they're always creating money. They've created the euro in Europe, which is another Federal Reserve dollar with no visible backing of any kind. I think it's in order to cover up the fact that they're creating so much money that they need to keep taxing people and convincing people that no matter what country you're a citizen of, you got to keep paying taxes to these people for all the wonderful services you get. They talk about government services, you know. They're always bringing that up. Well, we would have to cut services. We would have to cut the schools. And they even start closing libraries, you know, just to convince people to say, well, we can't have the libraries open at night anymore because we're so short of funds. And the national parks, you know, they charge you to go into national parks. Here they, every day they're sending billions of dollars overseas to various boondoggles. And the total budget of the whole national park system is like $100 million a year. But you hear these cries of desperation. We don't have money to fix the potholes in the parks. We don't have money to keep the campgrounds going. And this is one of the main sources of recreation for the American people are the national parks. And yet they're starving them to death because they feel like if you really want to go to a national park, why can't you pay a fee and go? That's their attitude, yes.
Of course, you know that the national parks have all been taken over by the United Nations, and they're called biospheres. The park fees have increased dramatically.
Oh, yes.
The rivers have been taken over by the Heritage River Foundation, so the rivers aren't ours anymore. The parks aren't ours. The revenue to go into, I mean, the amount that they charge to go into any place has quadrupled. And then they tell you no more snowmobiles in the national park.
Oh, yes.
Because they don't want us running into any nests of the foreign troops that they're training as we speak.
Oh, definitely.
So what about your conspiracy on top of conspiracy? I mean, this is a wall that's got to come down sometime. I think more than the tragedy of the money and the way they have stolen from us is the way they have destroyed our children.
Oh, yeah.
Destroyed our children in the wars, with their vaccine, with their chemtrails. Everything that they have done to us to destroy our children just makes me livid.
Oh, well, Davy Kidd, I was just talking to her here. Yes, she has a table here. She made a complete investigation of all the school shootings. She found that every child involved in those shootings was on Prozac and Ritalin and other of these mind-altering drugs. So you're right. Terrible crimes are being committed against the children and the parents. What can you do when the government poisons a child with mind-altering drugs? It's no longer your child anymore.
Well, worse than that, you whack your kid in the mall, and the next thing you know, you've got social services showing up to take your children away from you.
Oh, yes, child abuse.
You're damned if you're good. You're damned if you didn't.
Oh, that's right.
I mean, they have all the power.
They have power, and as I say, they use force.
Oh, yeah.
They can accuse you of child abuse, and you look out, and there's a car full of sheriff's deputies and everybody else there in your car, and you wouldn't dare resist. They'd blow you away just like that. Mm-hmm. In fact, they really like resistance. They'd like for you to come out shooting so they can use their guns, you know. And after all, it's very boring shooting at targets in the firing range of the police all the time. To get out and shoot some real people would be a great change. Oh, I think fun, and of course, maybe put a notch or two on the barrel, you know.
What do you think is the prognosis? What is our future?
Well, the prognosis is the government's going to get worse, and I think the people are going to resist more. I think that's the prognosis. You have the Internet revolution. This stuff is suddenly going all over the country instantaneously. I mean, before, people used to print little mimeographed newsletters 50 years ago and hand them out and reach 100 or 200 people. Now it goes over the country instantaneously. And also by seeing it so instantaneously, it has a more immediate effect. People are more enraged by it. I mean, when you get a newsletter in the mail that someone has mailed 2 weeks ago, it really doesn't excite you, but you pick something off the internet and my God, it hits you right in the head and you're ready to do something. No, I think the tide is turning against these people. They have abused us. They have abused and taken license with everything that they did, like printing the Federal Reserve money, which should never have been allowed in the first place, because the only thing they know to do with their ill-gotten gains is to attack the people, to enslave them more, hire more police and get more guns.
They take all the guns away from us, and we can't protect ourselves. So.
Well, that's what they've been trying to do for years.
And
they just haven't had the means to do it.
I know, but that's the way Russia was, and they couldn't defend themselves, and that's what happened to them.
Oh, yeah, Russia and Germany, they took the guns.
Yeah.
And no, as long as we still have privately owned guns, our freedom will last that long. The day the guns are gone, we're gone.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And it's happening.
Oh, yes.
Well, the big thing, I work in agriculture, and the international bankers are destroying agriculture in this country. And if you're not aware of that, I've studied that very extensively.
Oh, yes.
We now import half of our food.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And the people, if you're concerned about food safety, most of the food that comes in is not inspected, like less than 2%. It comes across the borders, is inspected. So be sure if you buy fruits and vegetables that you wash them well, because the rules are different. With the NAFTA, that's again, and the GATT agreements and WTO, they have just absolutely decimated the agriculture, and it's right now direct subsidies to the farmers will be 50% of this year's income.
My gosh, direct
50%.
Subsidy.
And so, guess what? Food control is population, is people control.
Well, it is, because they would rather have your food produced in another country and imported. Not only make a lot of money hauling it here, and they also make a lot of commissions on reselling it, but the food produced in Mexico and Chile and so forth, you see, many dangerous chemicals have been banned in this country,
right.
But Monsanto and Dow can send those chemicals to any other country,
right.
And they will produce the bright green lettuce and the big, beautiful grapes, but they're loaded with those chemicals. And we have no way of knowing that. As you say, they come across, they're not inspected. There's no way that our government agencies could ever inspect foreign farms to see how much of these pesticides they're using. So it was a great boon for the chemical companies after these things were banned here and they reduced their market here. They're selling even more overseas, because over there the market is unlimited. They don't have legislatures in those countries that will meet and ban dangerous substances, because there the only thing is to make money and survive. And so no, we're really endangered by the foreign produce coming in this country, because it's absolutely loaded with dangerous chemicals.
The trend is that with farming going out, we'll be in a position of surrender.
Oh yes,
because we're World War II, World War I, we produced our own food and quite a lot of excess. That's not really true anymore. Yes, we have an excess of a few commodities, but generally speaking, we're on a deficit here, and we're actually importing beans out of Canada now, packaging them in Twin Falls because they can buy them cheaper there because of the exchange rate.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
And the same way with potatoes. And the big corporations come to the growers, potato growers in Idaho where I live, and they extort them and say, well, if you don't take less money for your contract, and they're already basically at below production costs, even the best growers, and they say, well, we're going to take it to Canada. Well, they're going to take it to Canada. And you talk about the Second Revolutionary War, the British have won it economically.
Oh yes. Yeah, Canada right now is, Simplot there in Idaho, the great potato man,
yeah.
I think they have backed him into a corner. You know, he produces all the potatoes for McDonald's, or did. I think I read about a year ago that they were switching to to Canadian firms. I don't think he has those McDonald's contracts anymore.
Well, he has some, but, they've cut way back.
Oh, yeah.
And as they're increasing in Canada, They're just cutting us out of the picture. And the only problem they have, fortunately, climate-wise, Idaho has still the ideal climate.
Oh, yes.
And some of the other areas, that does make some differences when you're growing things. But still, they'll try to get around it. And we've taken our technology, our tax money, and helped produce food all around the world.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And the overseas, you might comment about the overseas private investment corporation, another misnomer.
Oh, it certainly
you might
is.
Want to tell people about that.
Well, they set up a number of those companies. Nelson Rockefeller set up one in South America, and it was called the International Overseas Company, I think. But there's a number of them. But Rockefeller set up his in Colombia. To invest the money that he made supplying the Nazi submarines with gasoline during World War II.
Exactly.
And Jedgar Hoover found out that he was doing this, and he goes rushing to Roosevelt. He thought he finally had the Rockefellers. And he said, Mr. President, the Rockefellers are supplying the Germans with their German battleships and submarines all through South America. And So Roosevelt said, well, thank you, Edgar. I'm so glad you brought me this information. And he put it in a file, and he already knew it anyway. But then Rockefellers had all this money after World War II, and so they invested it in these vast enterprises down there. And I think the Columbia drug trade is probably the natural outgrowth of the Rockefeller investments in Columbia. They claimed they were just growing coffee,
yeah.
But drugs are a lot more profitable than coffee, believe me. Yes.
Then you may want to talk about how Vietnam, the war was extended so they could continue to bring the drugs in and the cadavers.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that was another key.
Oh, that was a tremendous thing. All the bodies of our soldiers killed in Vietnam were brought home stuffed with huge bags of drugs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would open it up and take the drugs out and sell them and then go ahead and give the boys a good, decent burial. But that was just a means of transportation. These people are so cold-blooded and so ruthless,
yeah,
that the average American cannot begin to envision what they're like. Yes?
You mentioned earlier today that how they were trying to destroy the American people and make us paupers and everything, but for some reason the economy is still strong. And they haven't ruined it. Do you have any more information?
Oh, yes. I mentioned at that time that we simply responded by working harder and being more ingenious, developing new methods of production. So their efforts to destroy us just spurred us on to be more creative. And this prosperity is due almost entirely to the extraordinary pressures brought on by the measures, retaliatory measures, against the American people, to tax them more, to be more repressive, to have more government regulations, and to narrow our markets. And we responded by making more money than ever.
Well, you know, the other thing is, look at the contrails. They dump these millions of tons of chemicals on us every day, and we're still freaking here. We should have been dead years ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, we take all these wonderful medications from Rockefeller's drug companies, and that's what's keeping us going.
Unbelievable.
No, when they dump the contrails, we have to rush out and buy millions of dollars worth of medicines just to survive. So they win both ways.
But they will ruin us through agriculture.
Agriculture is the way they ruin us, because unless you live off of your land, mm-hmm, no country can survive without living off their own land. Now, Japan, of course, they don't have any room to grow food in Japan. I have been there many times. Every inch of the land is taken up by homes and factories.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have any fields of grain and all that sort of stuff. They have to import it all. But so the Japanese have to work twice as hard to produce enough money to buy their own food. And the consequence is they're totally under control. I have been ever since the military occupation. We still have 47,000 troops in Japan. So anybody that thinks that Japan is not occupied, I think in 52 or 54, they drafted some sort of agreement that Japan is now fully independent. Well, when you go to Japan, the press is totally controlled. The television is totally controlled. There's no dissent anywhere in Japan. It's like Soviet Russia was under Stalin. And the people don't mind this because Japanese are not very argumentative people anyway, and they just accept this, and they go along and work, and they live almost in hovels. The standard of living in Japan is awful. They have these enormous apartment houses were like barracks, and in these huge apartments, they only have like a room and a half for four people. It's really terrible. They have no room to park cars. They can't buy cars because there's no place to park a car. Only wealthy people in Japan have cars. So that's really why they inundated us and the rest of the world with their cars, because after they produced them in Japan, they couldn't sell them to the Japanese people because there's no place to put them. Very few people have a place in Japan to park a car. Well, I think in New York City and Manhattan, now it costs you about the same price as an apartment just to get a parking place. And when I lived there 50 years ago, it was still rough, but then it got to where you really had to buy a parking place in some enclosed garage, and it started at $200 a month, and now it's about $2,000 a month.
$2,000?
Oh, yes. Oh, the price of a parking place in Manhattan today is about the same as the price of an apartment.
You could afford a lot of taxis for that.
Well, they could afford taxis, but for some of them, they have enough money, and there's the prestige of owning your own automobile, and so they do that. It's just like John Kennedy. He had the prestige of owning his own airplane, but with all of his money, I thought he would have had a pilot, but instead he insisted on piloting himself, and so he's no longer with us because he and his $150 million fortune crashed, and that was the end of that.
Yes. You haven't heard the conspiracy.
Oh, yes, I've heard all conspiracy theories about Kennedy.
Well, I don't think that he crashed. I don't think he was incompetent at all. I think he was taken down.
Well, the information that they released immediately after the crash was so suspicious.
Yeah.
Here on the front page of every newspaper are these lurid, very detailed stories of how confused he was and totally lost,
like
didn't know he was up or down.
Like they were sitting there with him.
Yeah, well, they must have been in the cockpit. How would they have known all these things? They were very detailed. When you see that kind of manufactured propaganda, and it hits the press within hours after any of this stuff, and it's just like Hillary Clinton in her newspaper column when Ron Brown crashed in Yugoslavia. And in her column the next day, she told about the terrible weather, storms, and so forth. Well, in fact, there were no storms at all. But that doesn't bother them. They're given this propaganda, and they grind it out, and it appears in all the papers. Yes.
Remember the big secret operation of bringing up the plane, that they did this whole Kennedy thing with this big boat out there. You couldn't get too close. No, they wouldn't let any photographers.
Oh, no, top secret.
Said, oh, he's sitting right in that, you know, his head was against the window, and the whole front of it was just, the plane was just perfect, and he was just laying there against the window at the bottom of the ocean. But then they show, about a week ago, they showed this destroyed plane that looked like it's absolutely nothing but just a bunch of wreck.
Oh, yeah.
All of a sudden, it went from everything isn't perfect, there's just the tails missing, guy sitting there perfectly dead and beautiful, to this thing has been completely destroyed. And nobody even remembers that that's what we saw last September, was all that crap.
Well, I have heard from various people that the plane that they finally wound up with wasn't Kennedy's plane at all, which is probably true. That's the way they do things.
Everything.
Yeah, everything. They do it the same way. Well, I have a friend in Martha's Vineyard, and I'll be going there next month, and he sent me a clipping. When the Kennedy crash occurred, the Vineyard Gazette, which is one of the two newspapers on Martha's Vineyard, I printed a interview with one of the summer residents, a lawyer from Cincinnati, who said he was out in his yard working, and he saw this plane, and he saw an explosion and heard the explosion. And they printed his complete interview in the Vineyard Gazette. It was never picked up by any newspaper in the world. Here is an eyewitness to the Kennedy crash, and not one paper would touch it, and of course this man, you never heard of him again, whatever happened to him, I don't know. But that was actually printed in the Island Paper.
An article on that.
You saw the article on that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got the interview at home. I've got the complete article from the Vineyard Gazette.
He was fishing.
Yeah, fishing, and heard an explosion and looked up, and there was this explosion, yes.
Did you ever know Congressman Larry McDonald? He was the Ron Paul of his day.
No, he was a little before my time.
Yeah, well, he was, you know, everybody remembers KAL Flight 007.
Oh, yes.
September 1st, 1983.
Uh-huh.
And the first news reports, the newspaper I got on the front, said that the plane was down. They were negotiating for the release of hostages at Sakhalin Island.
Right.
I turn on the TV. 30 seconds later, they said the plane was down. There are no survivors.
Oh, yes.
And those people all, maybe with the exception of a couple of them, were put into Soviet prisons. In fact, through mm-hmm. the Soviet underground, Larry McDonald was seen.
Was seen, okay.
And I always thought it would be like Capricorn 1, if he could escape.
Yeah.
The boy would have blown things. I prayed for that for a long time.
Well, I'm sure they made sure he wouldn't escape. But no, I've heard those stories too about they're all held prisoner. But you see, they can't let him go because it would blow the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's just like when I was in the Air Force in World War II, we developed a system where the planes could fly from England and bomb Germany, and they didn't have enough gas to return. So they would continue on and land in Russia. Well, all the ones that landed in Russia, our loyal ally Stalin put them in prison camps because the system in Russia was you could never allow anybody from another country to come into Russia. If they did, they were never allowed to leave because they'd tell people what they saw there, how horrible the conditions were and how unpopular the government was. And so they were all in prison and never heard from again. Not one word from our military commanders who knew that the crews were being imprisoned in Soviet camps, and to this day, not one of them ever opened their mouth about it.
How about Operation Keel Haul?
Oh, Keel Haul was the most tragic thing of all. And there was I think a Hungarian Jew, and he became an officer in the British Army, and he was one of the principal overseers of that. I think his name was Lowe, and so years later, the story was published in England about how he oversaw Operation Keel Haul, and which was all true, but he sued for libel and got an enormous judgment against the people who said this.
Even though it's all true. Keel Haul, or what is that?
Well, you see, a lot of Russians were so relieved when the German army came into Russia. After all, they'd been living under a terrible dictatorship, and so they immediately... the soldiers surrendered without fighting, and they agreed to join, instead of becoming prisoners, they agreed to join the German army and become a large force of the German army, which they did. And they were led by General Vlaskov, who became one of the biggest division commanders of the German army. So, of course, when the war ended and they all surrendered, the Vlaskov Legion, as it was called, all of the former Russian soldiers were segregated and were turned over to the Soviet authorities. And many of them knew what was going to happen, and they tried to commit suicide. They had
many
no weapons. They did what?
They did commit, many of them.
Oh, many of them did commit suicide, even though the weapons had been confiscated. They stabbed themselves. They did all sorts of things, and sometimes they didn't have their weapons, and so it was only a partial thing, and they were all dragged away to the Soviet Union. Of course, they were all killed.
This was under the direction of Dwight David Eisenhower.
Oh, Eisenhower agreed, yes, that these traitors should be returned to Russia, to our loyal allies. No, it was one of the great atrocities of World War II. Today, it's almost entirely forgotten. There were books published about it. There were about 3 books published about it, Operation Keel Haul. And the story came out again later when Harold Macmillan became Prime Minister of Great Britain. And he was the British officer in charge of this whole thing. And I think that he employed the standard excuse. He was merely following orders. Well, actually, Eisenhower, who of course was his superior, had approved the turning over of the prisoners to the Soviet Union. And they were all killed.
There's something very nasty, another thing that happened with Eisenhower, and that's that he had these big camps set up where they took all the German soldiers that were left over from the war, put them in the camps where they died with no food, no protection from the elements, and no medicines, and they just died in heaps in these big open prisons with, I mean, supposedly these were prisoners of war.
Oh, yes, yeah. Geneva Convention.
Yeah, they just left them there to die by the thousands, millions.
There's a book out of that. Yeah, it was written by a Canadian.
Other Losses.
Oh, yeah, Other Losses. Yeah, that's a good book.
It makes you sick to your stomach.
Yeah. And the guy who wrote this was not pro-German or anything. He just heard about it and started looking into it, and he was appalled. He went ahead and wrote the book. And, of course, it had a very small sale because it was dismissed as pro-Nazi propaganda. And even Senator Joe McCarthy, who tried to defend some of the people who were being arrested and tortured in Germany, these soldiers, because many of them had relatives in Milwaukee, which was his district. He represented Wisconsin. And so he went on the floor of the Senate and described some of the personal stories that these relatives told him about how these men were being tortured. And he was immediately denounced as a Nazi apologist.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that was that was the beginning of the turning of the tide against Joe McCarthy. With that initial condemnation as a Nazi sympathizer, it was all downhill from there.
Yeah. Would you care to comment about the power structure and how they line people up once they get in the system so they don't get out? In other words, you're rewarded as long as you play the game.
Oh, right.
There was a movie called The Brotherhood of the Bell with Glenn.
Oh, I remember that movie, which is never shown on television today. Never.
You'll never see it, and you won't find it. Well, actually, it was a privately... I thought it was a commercially made movie, but it wasn't. It was a made-for-movie TV thing. And you won't find it now. They're just the copies that were taken off of TV.
What's the name of it?
Brotherhood of the Bell.
Bell?
Yeah, Brotherhood of the Bell. Now, you think you can buy any movie in this country that you want to see. You got thousands of video stores, but you cannot buy that movie. I know Glenn Ford's son, Peter Ford, who has a talk show in Hollywood. And so Peter was going to have me on his talk show, and people warned him I was too controversial, so he never did that. He's friendly to me, but he never has had me on his show. Art Bell did the same thing. So a lot of these talk show hosts, when they hear that I'm going to be on, they come under so much pressure.
Yeah.
And they tell them, well, it's your program or Eustace, which do you want? So they choose the program. And that's the only choice they've got, yes.
Tell us about Waco.
Oh, Waco was a training exercise for the Army, actually. And Koresh was set up all the way. I think what happened was they stored some weapons there under some pretext or other. And he said, sure, I got plenty of room, put them down there. Maybe they paid him. Maybe they paid him $300 a month or something for storage. So then they set up this thing that they were going to raid him for these weapons, you know. It was part of the gun grab lobby is what it was.
The weapons were stolen by the Mossad, from the armories all across the United States.
Oh, that's what they were?
And then he said that if you don't keep paying me, I might have to mention where these weapons came from.
Oh, yes.
And that's when they lowered the boom.
Oh, sure. So it was a Mossad Well, I knew all along that Waco was a Mossad operation, but I didn't realize they were Mossad's weapons.
The weapons were from where?
Stolen from the armories all across the United States.
By Israeli intelligence, Mossad.
Oh.
That's the arm of the...
That was the beginning of it.
Yeah. There's a book exposing the Mossad called By Way of Deception by one of their former agents, and they claim to have $1 million. He lived in Canada. And so L.T. Patterson, whom I wrote for, was going to have him come and speak at a meeting there that I was speaking at. And so they told him in Canada that if he left Canada, that he would not be allowed back. So he'd be stuck in the United States or go somewhere else. So he never came to the meeting. And they claimed the Mossad had $1 million contract on him. He's never been harmed, and he's made quite a lot of money out of his book, which has gone through several editions. So, yeah, I heard him lecture finally. He came to Washington and lectured. And it was a pretty standard story. His training as a Mossad agent and how they're trained to be totally ruthless, and when they're told to kill somebody, they have to kill them, and they do. They're really all assassins. They're trained as assassins. They don't always assassinate people, but that's part of their duties. If they're asked to do it, they have to do it. And yeah, Mossad is considered the most feared intelligence organization in the world.
What do you know about Oklahoma City?
Well, I was quoted on the editorial page of the New York Times after that the Oklahoma City bombing was a standard government operation. They quoted me and they never denied it. What I said, you would say, think that they would follow that up by saying, well, this is typical of Eustace Mullins or something like that. They didn't. They just printed my statement and with no comment. And then Red Beckman, a friend of mine from Montana, he was interviewed about it immediately. And so the Wall Street Journal interviewed him and they quoted him on the front page. He said, well, anyone who's familiar with this kind of thing knows that it's a government operation. And so they printed Red's story, and the New York Times printed mine, and there were other comments, and of course I talked about it on talk shows. And as I say, no one ever challenged these statements at all to this day.
Because the chief is stupid, and they're not paying attention. If you say the government operation, they'll think, yeah, the government cleaned it up.
Yeah, what I meant was a total...
Oh,
standard managed government operation, the way they do everything. And Oklahoma City was necessary because the terrorism bill was stalled and they had to get it through. So
passed 2 days later.
Yeah, passed 2 days later. Yeah, because it was absolutely stalled in Congress.
Right.
Nobody in Congress cared about the terrorism bill. There was no reason for it. And so they had to engineer this, and they did it. And they've done so many things like that. And well, there were people in Oklahoma City who had families that were victimized by this monster, Timothy McVeigh, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, they demonize you, you know.
Oh, I know. He's got a chip and he doesn't even have a clue what happened.
Yeah.
And all he did was drive around without a plate on his car, and the next thing you know, he's in the slammer charged with all this.
Well,
crap.
That becomes a capital offense, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
But, these things happen like this, and... Well, they demonize people. You see, after the Waco Holocaust, I call it the Waco Holocaust.
Wow.
And, I'm always, they always say, Eustace Mullins insists on calling it the Waco Holocaust. It makes them furious, but they can't do anything about it. And it is a Holocaust. So, you see, their contention is there's only one Holocaust, the one in Germany, and you're not allowed to use that anywhere else. Well, I use it wherever they massacre women and children, which they did at Waco. And so, I point out that even the Nazis, as far as I know, never herded an entire Christian congregation into the church and burned them alive, and which happened at Waco. So, but you know, not a so-called Christian minister in the United States would open their mouth about Waco. It's the strangest thing. You would have thought there had been one independent minister somewhere that would say, well, look, we shouldn't be burning congregations alive in their churches, because after all, that guy has a congregation also. Maybe he would be next. Who knows? So, but they let that pass without a comment.
Well, they're probably afraid of losing their tax credit.
Oh, all the tax credit.
Can we do a tape change?
Oh, yes. Go ahead. We'll take a pause for tape change.
Can I ask you a question
while I still have? What? You know, all that's been done. One of Bill Clinton's mentors, Tragedy and Hope, the book might be good.
Oh, Carol Quigley, yeah. I know the book, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and it wasn't that they come out with a second edition.
Yeah.
You might want to comment about it, because he just spilled the whole beans of what the whole game plan was.
Well, he did.
He was Bill Clinton's mentor.
Oh, he certainly was.
And, in fact, Bill Clinton mentioned him in his What Exception speech, I think it was. I believe it.
Oh, he did, yes.
Yeah.
He certainly did.
And
I spoke up at the radio talk show that I told you that was canceled on me. That was the Twin Falls. It was a young guy. That was in 92 during the...
Well, his boss is a bunch of women. I mean, they're really weenies.
Well, this guy was green. I mean, he was a kid. He sounded like he was about 20 years old.
Yeah.
Well, maybe
he's gone to St. George, Utah, but I don't have...
Oh, you know about him then, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he cut me off.
I was on his program.
Oh, okay.
I was on his program.
Well, no,
and the only reason he cut him off was because I'm sure he wouldn't have cut you off.
No. Somebody told him, stop this guy right now.
Yeah.
No, he may not even have pulled the switch and convinced somebody else.
They've cut all the talk shows off of that station now.
Oh. Well, talk shows have been cut down everywhere. But people start new ones, you know.
Because, see, they're getting under pressure to get relicensed.
Oh, yes.
To re-license renewal.
Oh, yeah.
They hold that record over there.
Oh, they got a lot.
They're whims.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They have, you know, they got four radio stations there.
in the Magic Valley and could do so much good. They have 1 hour left operating.
Mike, 1 hour. That's
1 hour left. That's all they've got. And I get on there whenever I get a chance.
See, Tom Donahue came up there in, I think, about 1988 and started a talk program, and he did real well. He was under a lot of restrictions because the present senator at that time from Idaho, Tom interviewed him, and he tried to have Tom taken off the air. He retired himself not long after that. Yes. All right, we'll resume our meeting now. We haven't got too much time left, so we will continue our question program, and we'll get ready for the grand wind up here. So I have a question over here. All right.
This is a two-part question. The first part is, where do you see the Federal Reserve going in the next 6 to 12 months? The second part is, people are throwing around these terms, national sales tax, flat tax. Is this just all a smokescreen?
Most of it's a smokescreen. Nearly all of these tax projections are disinformation or smokescreen, because they're really wallowing in such a surplus of money right now that they couldn't possibly use any more taxes. But that's the last thing they want to tell you, because the minute they mention that, everybody's going to quit paying. And so they have to continue this illusion that the government is depending on your money, and if they don't continue to get these taxes from you, everything's going to shut down. Everything will close, the libraries, the schools, there will be no police on the street, no fire departments. You know, they conjure up these horror stories, and people panic. Oh, well, what are we going to do? No fire department? My house will burn down? And, of course, there's absolutely no likelihood of any of this, but they got people so brainwashed that anything that these people say, no matter how ridiculous it is, it has its immediate effect. During the Reagan election, in 1980, there was a lady, she was a relative, and she was a widow, and she was very comfortably off, and she almost had a total nervous breakdown because the Democrats claimed that if Reagan was elected, he would shut down Social Security. And, you know, and this poor lady, she was about 70 years old, and she simply almost went into total collapse at the horrible prospect, and here she was actually very well cushioned. She had a nice home, steady income, and most of her Social Security checks she put in the bank to give to her grandchildren later on as part of her estate. But it was just the she just was so troubled by this that she just totally went into collapse. And this way, people are so conditioned that they think that all of these myths that the government turns out, and of course the government went into public relations in a big way during the 1930s under the Roosevelt administration. You know, Herbert Hoover didn't even have a telephone in the White House, and I don't think they ever thought of anybody doing public relations for government agencies at that time. This all came about during the 1930s, and once you set up a public relations department, it grows. You start off with one person, then they hire a secretary, then they hire a couple more people. I had a friend who worked in public relations at the Department of Commerce. And I think before you knew it, they had a department of about 30 or 40 people. Mostly with nothing to do, but that's fine too. You know? Get paid and not do any work. Yes?
I was wondering if you could give us your take on the constitutional aspect of the Federal Reserve. You didn't really address it today.
No, I didn't get into that because that's been talked about so much before. And, of course, Article 1, Section 8 specifically designates that Congress shall have the power to coin money and to regulate weights and measures, all of which have now been taken over by other agencies. And because Congress had this power, they really did not have the authority to delegate it to a private bank, because that abrogated the Constitution. And, of course, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 did not repeal any part of the Constitution. That wasn't part of it. And but it did give a delegated congressional power, was delegated to a private agency, which ordinarily, when that is done, there have to be special provisions made, special licenses and that they be held to a strict standard of performance. Well, the Federal Reserve Act of